virtual on my screen. I'm Emma. I'm a research fellow here at Public Law Project. When I'm not with PLP, I'm at the University of Exeter, where I've been doing a PhD about access to immigration advice, and most recently I've just started a postdoctoral research fellow position looking at the issues around remote advice provision. So I agreed to chair the event today because I guess a long-standing theme of my research work has been around the importance of face-to-face advice provision and the ways in which it might be qualitatively quite different to interactions that are carried out remotely. So I think it's really important that we need to be attuned to the way in which technology mediates our interactions and how it might also shape the ways in which we practice law and interpret the meaning of justice. So for example, there's really important socio-legal work by academics such as Linda Mulcahy on how the architecture of courts plays an important role in how law is exercised. So in her book, Legal Architecture, Justice, Due Process and the Place of Law, Mulcahy argues that our relationship with, that the environment in which the trial takes place can be seen as a physical expression of our relationship with the ideals of justice. So if we consider that the physical spaces of courts might be configured in very specific ways for a certain purpose, then we might also have to pay attention to how and why digital spaces might be different. And you can tell I'm reading from a screen that's above my other screen, and this is all very new, so please bear with us today as we work through these issues together. So not only have the digital platforms that we're going to be talking about today not being designed with justice system in mind, they're being repurposed for that use. And I'm referring specifically to the rapid changes over the last few weeks, because as we'll hear from our speakers today, there's actually a much longer process of reform and digitalization of the court system. So we'll be putting that a bit into context. And one thing that I think the longer term process of reform conducted by the Courts and Tribunals Service has really indicated to us is that these aren't easy changes to be making. So up until now, this process of shifting to digital services has been a much slower process. And before we move on to the speakers, I just really wanted to acknowledge that this is an enormous task and it's happening under extremely difficult circumstances at a time of national crisis. And so I think it's really important that we recognise that there are likely to be some issues with these changes. And in bringing this discussion together today, we certainly didn't want to criticise the kind of these incredible efforts that are being made to keep the justice system running. But I think we're also aware that there is a longer history of these concerns around digital reform and the implications for the principles that uphold our justice system. So with this in mind, some of the questions that prompted us to organise this are around sort of broadly what the practical advantages of remote hearings are in this context, as well as what some of the limitations might be and potential solutions. And some of the things that I think will come up today or kinds of questions that we might think about are how we might ensure that principles of open justice and transparency can be maintained as proceedings are moved to online and telephone formats. Does the use of remote technology change who is able to effectively participate in justice, and what might the different impacts be on different groups? Also, what are the experiences of litigants, and how might the remote configuration of justice systems exacerbate existing forms of disadvantage or produce new barriers to justice? So I'm sure other questions will come up through the session. The format's going to be that we're going to hear from our speakers in the first half, and we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back for some questions and answers. You can type questions as we speak through the chat function, and I'd encourage you to do that. And just bear in mind that as this is an online platform, please do keep them brief and on topic. Things are probably going to move a bit slower today than they would in person, so just be kind of sensitive to that. So our speakers today, who I am delighted to introduce, will be Matt Aluwalia from Public Law Project, Natalie Byron from the Legal Education Foundation, Joe Hines from Public Law Project and the University of Exeter, Simon Mullings from Edwards, Duthy Shamash, and Celia Kitzinger from Cardiff University, who I hope can stay with us because I know she's having some tech issues. So with on that note, I'm going to hand over to my colleague Matt, who's going to give us some context on the court reform and the kind of the history of the HMCTS reform programme. Thanks. Over to you, Matt.
Great. Thanks very much. Just introducing myself quickly for those who don't know. So I'm a barrister at Public Law Project, where I've been working since September 2017. And before that, I worked for a couple of different welfare rights organisations. And so my sort of legal interest, I suppose, is broadly sort of social welfare, in particular sort of social security and housing and public law issues. And I've also developed an interest in issues around, I suppose, online courts and public law and technologies whilst I've been at Public Law Project. And so that's where my sort of interest for today's purposes comes in. I've prepared a paper which hopefully you can all access now in the chat. If you can't, which you might not be able to if you've joined late, can you please let us know just by entering a message in the chat and we can send the link around again. I'm not going to be delivering a presentation or a PowerPoint. I'm just going to be speaking to camera. So you're welcome to follow along with the paper if you find it helpful, or you may prefer just to sort of download and keep it and then sort of refer back to it as you need to. If you are going to follow along, it might be easier to download it because the PDF has got bookmarks in it to help you sort of navigate between topics. And do feel free to come back to me on any points that arise out of that paper. I'm mainly going to be speaking on sort of two main points that are covered in the document. Firstly, on the relevant statutory provisions, and then secondly, on the sort of background context to the HMCTS reform program prior to the coronavirus crisis. So on statutory provisions, it's worth keeping in mind, I think, that in addition to the new provisions that are introduced by the Coronavirus Act, there are broad powers and duties in the Courts Act 2003 and in the Tribunals, Courts and Enforcement Act 2007. Those are duties which are on both the Lord Chancellor and the Senior President of Tribunals respectively. And those duties include, for example, a duty to ensure an efficient and effective system to support the carrying on of the business of the courts and tribunals, a duty to provide and maintain courthouses and offices and other accommodation that might be appropriate or that appear appropriate to the Lord Chancellor, as well as making arrangements for the provision of equipment and technology that the courts and tribunals are going to need. And there's also a duty, a sort of separate duty, on the Senior President of Tribunals to ensure that in carrying out the functions of that office, of that position, that the Senior President has to have regard to the need for tribunals to be accessible, to be fair, and for proceedings to be handled quickly and efficiently. The only authority that I've found on those duties is the case which actually tried to challenge the closure of a magistrate's court building, and the High Court essentially confirmed that actually these are quite broad and general powers, and in respect of maintaining accommodation and maintaining court buildings, they don't by themselves require consultations before courthouses are open or closed. So we've got a set of quite broad powers already, even prior to the new issues that the Coronavirus Act sort of brings up, as well as provisions in the CPR and the civil procedure rules, which are contained in the court's broad case management powers, that the court can hold a hearing and receive evidence by telephone or by any method of direct oral communication. So a lot of the powers that we're now seeing coming into force or coming into effect because of this crisis have been around for a little while. And on that note, it's worth sort of considering, I think, that the changes that we're now seeing can be seen as part of a sort of acceleration or ramping up of the broader reform program that HMCTS have been embarking on since September 2016 now. And I'm just going to talk for the next sort of 3 or 4 minutes on a few sort of key points on that reform program. First thing I want to just mention is that when we talk about access to justice, I think it's worth recognizing that it doesn't just mean being able to get to court quickly, and it's not just about keeping costs down. It also means, I think, access to legal advice and representation, where that's needed, where that's required. It means being able to participate in fair and effective hearings. It means that the processes are open and transparent, and it means that people can receive lawful decisions with adequate reasons, and that those decisions can be enforced. So I think it's important to keep that in mind, that we're not just talking about, you know, can you get your case moving forward? Can you progress things? But can you incorporate all of those factors when we're assessing whether a process ensures or enables access to justice? So I think that's worth bearing in mind, because a lot of the time when you look at the literature around the reform program, there was a sense that the focus for HMTTS was on speed and efficiency and costs, perhaps more than those other factors. And so on the reform program, I think there's a few notes just worth bearing in mind. The first is, I think it's worth recalling the sort of rise and fall of the online procedure rules, as the relevant bill, which tried to introduce those rules, didn't complete its passage through Parliament. It was introduced, I think, in sort of spring 2019. It might have been a bit later than that. But I think it's worth keeping an eye out for any resurrection of that bill, because had that completed its passage through Parliament, we may have already had a procedure rule committee on online proceedings, and we may have already had an idea of what online procedure rules might have looked like, which we don't currently at the moment. And I think as the crisis hopefully doesn't continue for too much longer, but as things sort of keep going as they are at the moment, with more of a shift to remote hearings, it will be worth considering what changes to the bill as it previously existed we would now push for, given people's experience of remote hearings, which I'm sure we'll be hearing more about later. Second point I want to just make about the reform program is the connection between those reforms and the maintenance of court buildings. As you may be familiar, the reform program was linked quite closely to the closure of a number of court buildings over the last few years. The justification a lot of the time being that money that is saved from not having to maintain those buildings and money that is made from selling them is reinvested in the reform program. So there is a connection between the two activities. And I think it's worth bearing in mind for today's purposes, because HMTTS have said in their daily operational summaries, which some of you may have been getting, that they're continuing to consolidate their work into fewer and fewer buildings. And so it would be worth keeping an eye on what HMTTS or the Ministry of Justice do in terms of future court closures and what justifications are put forward. We've been told that there aren't currently any plans to close further buildings, but as more people get experience of remote hearings and different ways of working, I think it's really worth keeping an eye on how that plays out, and whether there's any evidence that we want to think about putting forward if another court building is sort of selected for closure in the future. And then finally, the last point I just want to mention about the reform program is that it's not just about sort of digitization and reducing reliance on paper, but it's also about other methods of dispute resolution. And some of those did sort of evolve over the last couple of years, and some of them I think will continue to evolve and progress as hearings remain sort of online or remote. One of which PLP looked at in a little bit of detail, which was the model for personal independence payments and early evaluation, which had quite a number of quite alarming concerns really about how that was going to work. Because on the face of it and on the information that we had, there wasn't any room for legal representatives. There wasn't any sort of accommodation for legal arguments, just for taking evidence really over this remote sort of inquisitorial system. And there were a number of unclear messages about appeal rights and how cases would progress through the system. And given that, for example, in the Social Security Tribunal, and I believe in other tribunals, there's now more of an emphasis on judges sifting and triaging hearings and seeing which ones can be determined on paper, I think it's worth keeping an eye out for any new developments in other forms of dispute resolution or other forms of resolving appeals that aren't necessarily hearings or adversarial necessarily. the, just to sort of give a little bit of colour, the one for personal independence payment involved a sort of online panel where questions would be asked of an appellant. The appellant would then have a set number of days for answering those questions. And then the panel would come back with an early sort of preliminary view on whether they thought the appeal should succeed or not. And then the appellant would then have the option of declining that early view and proceeding to an oral hearing, or accepting that oral hearing, accepting the preliminary view and the appeal ending at that point. There's some details in the paper, but that's a sort of early idea, or one of the ideas that HMCTS have been exploring. And I think a pilot was due to finish, I believe, this summer. I've not yet seen any updates on sort of progress about that, but that was my understanding of how they were sort of developing that idea. And I wouldn't be surprised if other ideas around sort of dispute resolution evolved as a result of what's been happening. So that's really all I wanted to say in the time that I had. What I'll do is I'll put my email address in the chat if anybody wants to come back to me about anything in the paper. And I'll be around for the rest of this session if there are any questions for me, or if anything else that I can help with later on. But with that, I will mute myself and hand over to the next person. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Matt. I'm not sure what the etiquette is on clapping on Twitter, but I'm sure everybody is showing their appreciation in some way. Excellent. That's a really good idea. So the next person to speak will be Natalie Byron from the Legal Education Foundation. Thanks.
Thank you, Emma, and thank you so much to Public Law Project for inviting me to speak on the panel today. It's such a pleasure to be here, although it was quite sobering to have to attempt to get back into some of my work clothes, so there is that. As Emma said, I'm Director of Research at the Legal Education Foundation. I've been seconded to HMCTS as Expert Advisor on Academic Engagement and Open Data. I sit on the Administrative Justice Council, on the Litigants in Person Engagement Group subgroup of the CJC, and on the academic panel advising around the evaluation of reform. My background in this, I did my PhD in law with a focus on access to justice. So to begin, and it's worth saying, I've popped some of the reports that I produced as a consequence of my secondment to HMCTS in the chat, and if anyone has difficulties accessing them, more than happy to relink them. So to begin, I want to preface what I'm going to say here with an express acknowledgement, as Emma mentioned, that the arrangements that have been put in place as a consequence of the current pandemic have been created in good faith. People require the protection of the justice system, perhaps now more than ever, and no one who has read about the terrible increase in calls to domestic violence helplines can possibly doubt this. HMCTF staff, judges and lawyers are all under tremendous pressure. Unlike many other justice systems across Europe and worldwide, in England and Wales, we didn't pause even for a week to consider our options. Primacy was given to keeping the show on the road. However, we are now 3 weeks into a new normal that is likely to persist for many months. And in many ways, as Matt's excellent presentation highlighted, the present situation has simply led to an acceleration of trends that were already in motion. As such, it's imperative that we adjust our thinking away from "we are in crisis" and reflect on the precedents that we are setting with our current practices. It is also vital that as a community, we use our collective voice to ensure that lessons are learned from what happens during this period. And that includes putting pressure on the courts to record the hearings that are taking place and collect data on the experience of those who are accessing hearings during this time. And I commend Public Law Project for their rapid attempts to gather some of that data in this context. So in this short presentation, I'm going to focus on three cross-cutting areas of concern that are raised by the current arrangements and propose some potential mitigations for your consideration. The three cross-cutting areas of concern are: one, the impact of the rapid shift to remote hearings on access to justice and the rule of law; two, the impact of shift to remote hearings on the ability to support parties who may be understood to be vulnerable; and three, the impact of the shift to remote hearings on key principles of open justice. So firstly, access to justice and the rule of law. As Matt alluded to, the common law in England and Wales establishes a definition of access to justice that can be summarised as consisting of four parts. Firstly, access to the formal legal system. Secondly, access to a fair and effective hearing. Thirdly, access to a decision in accordance with law. And fourthly, access to an outcome. More information about the legal basis of this definition is found in the paper Developing the Detail, which I've linked in the chat window. In the context of the current situation, the primary concerns relate to access to a fair and effective hearing, and consequently, access to a decision and an outcome that reflects the merit of the case rather than any other factors. So it's worth saying that successive studies have raised concerns regarding the impact of remote hearings on the ability of litigants to participate effectively in proceedings. Research indicates that litigants whose cases are heard remotely secure worse outcomes than those whose hearings are held in person. The reasons for this are poorly understood. However, explanations include A, that litigants do not appreciate the seriousness or finality of proceedings conducted remotely and therefore do not avail themselves of legal advice. B, that the mode of hearing impairs the ability of litigants to communicate with their legal representative when they have questions or concerns or are finding proceedings difficult to follow. C, that technical issues relating to the technology used make it more difficult for parties to follow proceedings. In addition, in the current circumstances, lack of parity of technology and broadband may undermine fairness between parties. D, that the change in mode of hearing affects perceptions of credibility and it impacts on the decision-making of judges. And E, that it is harder for the court to discern whether litigants are vulnerable when they appear remotely. This means that vulnerable litigants may not secure the reasonable adjustments that the court is able to provide to facilitate their effective participation. A further concern is raised by the variations in practice adopted in response to the crisis. There is emerging evidence that different judges are using different platforms and different technologies to conduct remote hearings, not just the HMCTS video hearings platform, which was developed for this purpose. And also that different judges are adopting different stances in relation to interpreting when fairness may be undermined by proceeding remotely. This sort of differing attitude to risk risks undermining the fairness and the consistency of the justice system as a whole. So the second broad area of concern relates to the impact of the shift to remote hearings on parties who are recognised as vulnerable under existing law and practice directions. A growing body of evidence indicates that certain categories of litigant may be particularly disadvantaged if their cases are heard remotely. Litigants who are particularly at risk include young adults, litigants who have English as an additional language, whether or not they're assisted by an interpreter, litigants who are neurodiverse, have a learning disability, or who are experiencing mental health. And we know that litigants of that kind are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system. Litigants who are experiencing issues with drug or alcohol abuse, or litigants who experience fear or distress in relation to their case. These issues may be considered to be particularly acute in the context of defendants in criminal cases and those detained in immigration settings or in mental health settings. The current arrangements that have been established in response to the crisis place emphasis on the role of judges in identifying parties who are vulnerable. As such, it's vital that all members of the judiciary who are involved in the conduct of remote hearings are made aware that the above groups are more likely to be disadvantaged by hearings that are conducted remotely and provided with detailed, effective guidance on how to identify vulnerable litigants in a remote setting. The need for this guidance is particularly acute given that restrictions on the availability of medical professionals such as community mental health nurses, liaison and diversion practitioners, and legal advisors, who in the criminal context at least often provide this function. In the criminal and family jurisdictions, one response would be to make fuller use of ground rules hearings to identify and address vulnerability. Unfortunately, despite being 3 years into a reform programme, there is a lack of existing evidence regarding what constitutes an effective adjustment in relation to remote hearings, beyond adjourning and shifting to an oral hearing or providing legal or other face-to-face support. One solution in criminal hearings might be to relax strict rules on intermediaries for defendants. So steps should be taken to ensure that all judges are aware of their inherent powers to appoint intermediaries and to direct for additional support. The third area of substantive concern relates to remote hearings and open justice. And there's a brilliant blog that was written by Thomas de la Mer, who I believe is actually in the session. I saw his name pop up and that I would really urge people to read. So the shift to remote hearings raises concerns in relation to open justice, particularly in light of inconsistencies in the availability of technical solutions that would enable the live broadcast of hearings, which I know is something that PLP were pushing for. In addition, however, privacy and related concerns raised by the live broadcast on the internet of hearings have not been fully debated. There are issues in relation to the monitoring of unauthorised recording and redistribution were this approach of live streaming to be adopted at scale, and these need thinking through. In addition, in the absence of the availability of comprehensive court listings, journalists and members of the public and researchers have raised concerns regarding their ability to identify cases that would be of interest in time to be able to access remote hearings that are taking place. Emerging evidence suggests that the ability to access remote hearings is inconsistent across the country, and that's a cause for concern. To balance these concerns in the immediate term, the following safeguards could and should be adopted. Firstly, listings should be published online, which clearly state whether remote hearings are held in public or in private, and court lists should be published at least 24 hours in advance to enable those interested in observing to make arrangements to join the hearing remotely. Any reporting restrictions should also be published online to ensure that those people who are joining hearings remotely are aware of their responsibilities. Alongside listings, guidance should be published setting out who to contact to arrange to observe. And at the beginning of each hearing, the judge should ask all those present to undertake not to record proceedings and to confirm that everyone who is on the call or on the Zoom chat or Skype is entitled to be there. Fundamentally, it's my really strong contention that all remote hearings undertaken during this period should be recorded, at least for the purposes of us being able to understand what happened to the justice system during this period. And transcriptions should be made to enable public scrutiny. Thank you so much again for having me here today, and I look forward to hearing your questions, thoughts and suggestions on how any of the issues that I've raised in my presentation can be addressed. So thank you. Handing back to Emma.
Thanks very much, Natalie. And I'm sure there will be lots of questions at the end. So moving swiftly on to our next speaker, who is Jo Hines from Public Law Project. Over to you, Jo.
Hi, great. Thanks so much. So I'm Jo Hines, I'm a research fellow at PLP, as Emma said, looking at issues of remote justice, and also a PhD candidate at the University of Exeter, where I look at immigration, bail hearings and video technology. So what I want to explore in my 5 odd minutes is firstly, some key trends across jurisdictions that the user experience survey PLP has been running has highlighted. And then I want to look specifically at the immigration tribunals, which is the site of my own PhD research. So we began circulating a brief survey to court users almost 3 weeks ago now, and so far we've had 65 responses. So I've popped the link in the chat bar. So if anyone here has any experiences of using courts and tribunals recently, particularly those conducted by remote hearings, please do complete the survey and I'll put it in again after I've finished speaking. So I'm just going to outline 4 common themes that we're seeing so far. Firstly, there's been general confusion around whose responsibility it is to arrange a remote hearing and also pay the cost of it. The HMCTS guidance states that it's the responsibility of HMCTS to do this, but it doesn't seem that everyone has been experiencing it in this way. Secondly, there's been significant obstacles presented by poor quality live video and audio links, as Natalie has already touched on, which to some extent perhaps is to be expected, despite being wholly undesirable. But I should highlight that some responses did note that they recognise the behind the scenes work going on to address these issues and the fact that this was happening at a time of crisis. Also, the last minute confirmation from HMCTS about whether hearings would be adjourned or take place via telephone or video link was also an issue for many, particularly in the Social Security Tribunal. And this meant it was really difficult to get the tech in place at the claimant side before the hearing. So those are issues around video link and audio links in particular. Thirdly, many expressed concerns around how open justice was being maintained. Several responses highlighted the lack of press or public presence, and they were unsure how public observers would even be able to access hearings. So I've been trying to contact the administrative court all week to remotely observe hearings there. And this is a little difficult because, as Natalie says, the cause lists aren't always released with much notice and you have to give a specific hearing what you want to observe. So there's some sort of teething troubles around that, definitely. And that's a massive gap, I would say, in the current response. And finally, people expressed concern about future backlogs of cases. So they saw this as potentially being caused by both the adjournment of cases now and by a future possible wave of appeals of decisions made during the current sets of guidance. So that's a brief overview of our survey responses so far. And thanks so much to everyone who's contributed to or shared the survey. And I would encourage more responses because things are changing all the time and we're keeping on top of looking at the responses. So please do contribute. So now specifically at the immigration tribunals, as with every jurisdiction, there's been a deluge of guidance notes and new ways of working. But I want to talk particularly about the immigration tribunal because I think there are things that we can learn about the tribunal's use of remote hearings with vulnerable appellants before this pandemic that are useful for thinking about how remote hearings affect vulnerable appellants in any jurisdiction using remote hearings now. So there's an interesting discussion to be had about who is rendered more vulnerable by the use of remote hearings. I think we all are to some extent because it's just not how we're used to communicating. And perhaps we'll have time to unpack that later on. But thinking about the specific vulnerabilities or systemic barriers that some people experience more than others is helpful. And this really ties into what Natalie has already highlighted. So my research into immigration bail hearings points to multiple possible vulnerabilities or potential barriers, including being unrepresented, needing an interpreter, being detained, or being presented in court via a video link. But what's important here, I think, is that with the use of remote hearings, not only are all the traditional barriers to accessing justice exacerbated, they also interact and snowball in quite different and new ways. Plus there's new barriers. So for example, having a quiet private space at home with fast Wi-Fi. So take for example, and this is a scenario that I've observed during my research, an immigration bail applicant who's detained in prison, so might find it especially difficult to access legal representation. Then without this legal representation, the applicant might find it more difficult to ensure that the interpreter that they need in their hearing offers simultaneous interpretation. And then throw in a remote setting, and it becomes very difficult for the applicant to remain fully engaged with their hearing, which as we know is one of the tenets of access to justice. And research tells us that it leads to less favourable outcomes for applicants. So the question of how we frame barriers to access to justice takes on a whole new form in remote hearings because of this interaction of factors. And I don't think that's something we've had much chance to consider in the past couple of weeks of frantic activity, but it's certainly worth not losing sight of and drawing on research perhaps before this pandemic to help inform how we go forward. So in particular at the minute in the immigration tribunals, we lack the clear published guidance for both judges and parties on how to ensure effective participation in the proceedings that Public Law Project has called for, amongst others. Other jurisdictions are demonstrating great best practice, both the Court of Protection and the Family Courts has developed really thoughtful, comprehensive guidance about remote processes in conjunction with their user groups. And I think this is something that would also be really helpful in the immigration tribunal. That's it for me. I'll ping my email address and a couple of recent articles and papers which relate to these discussions in the chat bar. But I'd be really interested in your questions later, and after the event, do get in contact. Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks very much, Jo. I'm aware of time, so I'll just hand straight over to Simon Mullings, who's from Edwards Duthy Shamash, who's going to speak next.
Okay, thanks very much, everybody. Thank you, PLP, for inviting me to speak. It's both terrifying and flattering to be invited to speak along such brilliant and other fluid speakers. If I suddenly go still and I'm not saying anything, then the best thing to do is just pretend that I'm buffering, which in a certain sense, that's exactly what I will be doing. So I've got five things to talk about, which I'll have to gallop through. The first is vulnerability and remote justice. We've touched on that already, but the issue on vulnerability will run sort of through what I want to say. The second is about cowboy films, well, obviously. Third, courtrooms and shared cultural knowledge. Fourthly, alienation and aptitude. And lastly, if there's time, something about outcome versus process and the importance of the performance of justice. So my experience of starting to think about these things comes from being mostly a court housing possession duty advisor. And when I first started thinking about remote justice, it was really about my clients having to schlep halfway across town to an unfamiliar court because their local court had been shut down. But as the court reforms have progressed, it's become clear that video and other technologies are being touted as a solution for that. And so it seemed necessary to start thinking about that in terms of my client base. The next thing was that my clients are I'm a legal aid lawyer, so vulnerability is almost, without generalizing too much, but it's almost, you know, baked into the work that I do. So in thinking about this, it's very important to think about what we mean by the word vulnerability. Natalie earlier set out an impressive taxonomy of ways of thinking about vulnerability. And I want to think about that, but also about vulnerability in two different ways, about a person being vulnerable, but a wider sense also about being vulnerable to something. And hopefully through the talk, that'll become a bit clearer. I mean, it's relatively easy to appreciate how a vulnerable person might be disadvantaged by remote hearing technologies, but also ways in which technologies may enhance access to justice for some vulnerable groups of people. But while, for example, I would probably not be considered as a vulnerable person, I am certainly a person who is, well, for example, vulnerable to hop-based fizzy drinks and things like that. So, but without being supercilious about it, there's a wider group of people that we need to think about who might be vulnerable to the processes of remote justice. Now I want to talk about cowboy films. Well, not cowboy films per se, but about genre. Because I think it might be useful in thinking about the transition that is almost certainly going to happen from traditional forms of court hearings to remote and probably video forms of court hearings. If we think about, it doesn't have to be cowboy films, it could be horror films, it could be romantic comedies, but if we think about genre in film, the way in which genre is made up is of a number of different attributes to a cultural artifact like a film that defines what the film is about, what the film looks like, all sorts of features about the film. It's about the settings, it's about the mise-en-scène, what actually goes into the shot of the film, it's about the characters. All of these things go towards defining what a particular genre of film is like. And, you know, if I talk about a cowboy film, I'm sure all of you can picture scenes from a cowboy film, you can picture the costumes of a cowboy film, you can picture the saloon bar, there's all sorts of things that you... And what I'm trying to say is that there is a huge amount of cultural knowledge about the genre of cowboy film, that even if you don't like cowboy films, even if you never watch cowboy films on a Sunday afternoon, you are aware of that, you know, the word cowboy films brings these things to mind. So why am I talking about cowboy films? Well, because I think it's useful. Well, films and fictions are the ways in which we, you know, reflect our worlds to ourselves, but also the way in which we shape our experience of the real world as well. And I think, as I say, this may be a useful way of thinking about a real courtroom hearing and a remote hearing. So let's think about a real life courtroom hearing. I mean, again, I'm sure in your mind you can picture it right now. And there's no doubt that this is a highly theatrical space. Emma spoke about the physical architecture of courts. earlier, the space is highly theatrical. The hierarchy of roles is very, very carefully encoded and inscribed into the physical space. And the roles of the participants in the court are very highly circumscribed, further emphasized by costume, wigs, gowns, the mise-en-scène, not the gavel, because gavels aren't used, apparently, so I'm told. But all of these things are part of that court experience. And so what I want to suggest is that a traditional court hearing can be usefully considered as a sort of genre of a means of delivering justice. So if we go back to films and fiction, there is, of course, a genre of film and TV and novels, which is the courtroom drama. And this is important because I want to suggest that virtually every adult person, whether they know it or not, has a huge amount of culturally derived knowledge about traditional courts and court hearings from film, from TV, from radio, local newspaper reports. And while courts are doubtless somber, for some people intimidating places, I want to argue that anybody entering a courtroom for the first time will bring with them that cultural familiarity with many, many aspects of the courtroom, the characters, the costume, all the things that we talked about. And I think as a result, they find their place within the space and the narrative of a court hearing relatively easily. Is that possible with a hearing by Skype? Well, at the moment, not so much, I would say. All of the trappings, all of the kind of genre markings of the court hearing are not there. You don't even have a courtroom that you can speak of. It's a sort of scattered, decentralized experience. And so all of that cultural knowledge doesn't work for the person entering the courtroom, and therefore for them to find their place within that hearing, within that narrative, within that setting is much more difficult and can leave, I would say, participants feeling uncomfortable and alienated. Now, I don't have experience of video hearings. I've done telephone hearings in the past. They seem to fall out of the fashion, but are they coming back with a fashion now? The telephone hearings that I've done traditionally the outcome has been absolutely, it's a foregone conclusion what was going to happen. The telephone hearing was simply just to rubber stamp it, really. But just thinking about that uncomfortable, alienated experience of a remote hearing, I was struck, and we'll hear more about this from Celia in a moment, but I was struck about her piece for the Transparency Project about the AAF case, which I'm sure many of you have read, if not all of you. And the person who Celia was supporting says, as reported by Celia in that piece, about the remote justice hearing, it definitely made me feel like an outsider. In a courtroom, I'd have felt like it was more of a level playing field. I know there's the pomp and the ceremony of the court, but you can see the pecking order from me at the bottom to the judge at the top. So you feel better because you know the structure. The visible structure makes you feel safer. But this, referring to the remote hearing, felt chaotic, which made me feel nervous and insecure. Quite so, I think I would have done as well. And I make no presuppositions about Sarah, not her real name, or about her characteristics, or whether she would consider herself a vulnerable person or not a vulnerable person. But I would say that anybody conducting a remote hearing is at risk of being vulnerable to the mode of justice that's being employed there because of the slightly alienating aspects of it. I'd argue that it's difficult to put your best case aptly to the court in such circumstances because of being culturally untethered and alienated from the whole experience. I'd suggest that the lawyer classes and other professional middle classes, and I guess that's us, isn't it, will easily and quickly adapt to this world. And on Twitter, people are already congratulating themselves. But I don't think that's true of everybody. And we need to be extremely careful to make sure that there is not a sort of two-tier experience if these technologies are going to be adopted wholesale. I wanted to say, if I have time, Emma, just a couple more remarks. Joshua Rosenberg wrote on the 6th, what's that, 2 days, it feels like 3 weeks ago, it's 2 days ago, regarding the AF hearing that Celia wrote about. And he wrote something struck me about that. And Joshua Rosenberg wrote, anyone reading Mustin's ruling, Judge Mustin this is, can see that he reached the right result. Rosenberg's article is applauding the fact that this went as a remote hearing. That seemed an extraordinary thing to write to me, because it suggested that the result was a priori correct. There was a correct result before the hearing, and the hearing simply rubber stamped that correct result. Well, that's not what a court hearing is, because otherwise you wouldn't need a court hearing. It seemed like the right outcome existed externally and anterior to the actual process of the hearing itself. But that can't be right, because we can't know what sort of outcome there would have been had the mode or the genre of the process been different. So that seemed an extraordinary thing to say, and it seemed to carry with it a warning about remote justice. The second part about that piece was that it appeared that Mr. Rosenberg was asking Sarah to set aside her feelings about the outcome. Sorry, if you haven't read the piece, the daughter of the person about who the hearing was held was unhappy about the. You'll hear more about this from Celia, and maybe this will slot into place a bit. But she was unhappy about the mode of hearing. So Joshua Rosenberg is asking Sarah to set aside her feelings about that because the correct outcome had been reached, and it had been reached efficiently with technology that all the lawyers seem to be very happy with. And Mr. Rosenberg seems to be making a wider point about remote hearing technologies themselves, that followed through suggests that in a wider sense, society should set aside its concerns about how the process of how such an outcome is reached. But again, that seems to me to carry warnings that we who are concerned about this process, who are not necessarily against remote technologies, but who are concerned about the process to moving towards remote technologies as a default way of doing hearings, these warnings need to be heeded, I think, and we need to work very hard, I think, to make sure that the sort of, I suppose, the prejudged a priori nature of justice, which is implied by what Joshua Rosenberg is saying, to make sure that that's not baked into these proceedings. In the meantime, I mean, obviously we need remote justice now because we're in this crisis, but in the longer term, people want justice from people, really. They want to look people in the eye. They want to be in the room with them. They want their own physical responses, their own physical language to be, you know, beholden by the court, as it were. And they want to feel that's sometimes called the majesty of the court. Well, that may seem conservative with a small c, but well, I agree. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon. Thanks. I'm just aware of time. And I know Celia has sent us a video to watch of her talk. And I just want to check with Aid whether we're able to link people into that now. Or Emily.
Has Celia dropped out because of her internet?
Are you sure Celia isn't here?
Celia is in the room. room, but she can't play her video without her internet dropping out because it doesn't support her.
Fine. I can get it going.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Simon. I think those are really interesting and important comments, and actually everything that's been said up to this point is really insightful, and we really appreciate you all being able to speak to this topic today. Hopefully we should be able to see Celia speak.
From Cardiff University, where I co-direct the Coma and Disorders of Consciousness Research Centre. As part of our research, we study best interests decision-making, including in the court of protection. And one outgrowth of that work has been that we provide informal, unofficial support to family members going through this process. It was in that role that I was due to attend Nottingham Civil Justice Centre between 17th and 20th March this year to support someone I call Sarah. She was the daughter of the patient at the centre of this serious medical treatment case. And the issue was whether his life-sustaining treatment, the clinically assisted nutrition and hydration, should be continued or not. The case was heard before Mr. Justice Mostyn. There were five parties, so Sarah was the second respondent, and there were at least 20 participants all attending remotely. The initial claim about the way in which this worked as a remote hearing was very positive. Mr. Justice MacDonald, who wrote in his guidance on the Remote Access Family Court, said that it had been universally positive. Two of the barristers involved have reflected on it and wrote, "What did we miss?" because it was a remote hearing. In truth, nothing that mattered. That wasn't Sarah's experience, and it wasn't my experience. So with Sarah's support, I wrote a Transparency Project blog in which I reflected on what it had been like for us. So like the barristers who also wrote about it, that we acknowledged that there were technical issues, intermittent loss of connectivity, batteries going, recording problems, audio lag, and some bandwidth issues. But overall, it actually worked technically much better than we expected. But it didn't work as an interpersonal interaction. It didn't work to feel like justice. For Sarah, the daughter of the patient at the centre of the case, it felt like a second best option. It didn't feel professional. It didn't feel like justice. Sarah lost the case. The decision made for her father wasn't the one that she wanted. And because of the fact that it was held remotely, she's left wondering, she says, should I have waited and insisted on a face-to-face hearing? She's left with that doubt. So what went wrong with the fact that it was a remote hearing? One of the problems was that because of the bandwidth problems, the judge asked for the cameras to be switched off if people weren't actually asking questions or answering at the time. So except when Sarah was giving her witness statement and being cross-questioned about that, she was quite literally invisible to the other people in the virtual court. They spoke about her in the third person. They couldn't see her reactions. They were unable to assess how upset she became at certain issues and at certain points during the hearing, unable to offer her a break, unable to modify their behavior in ways that I've seen happen in real courtrooms. Sarah herself says, in a courtroom where people can see body language, they can feel the pain and emotion when you speak about that moment of utter desperation that you went through. But I was a little one-inch box on a screen. And she says, I wanted to look them in the eyes and make them hear the truth, but I was looking at a computer screen. It also felt incredibly informal. The gravitas of the courtroom just wasn't there. Partly it was the absence of the architecture. Instead, we got backdrops of people's homes. As she says, she wanted her father to have his day in court, not in somebody's lounge. More than that, there was the usual camaraderie, the joking, the messing about that goes on between lawyers and sometimes between lawyers and the judge. That often happens in the front benches. The family is seated at the back. But this came to everybody equally via the internet. Distracting pets created little moments of jocularity and distractions. Mobile phones went off for one witness repeatedly. Some people were wearing quite casual clothing. It made Sarah feel, she said, like an outsider because she didn't have the structure, the ceremony of the court. The pecking order, as she called it, wasn't apparent. And the structure had gone, and that made her feel she didn't know where she was. She said it felt chaotic, which made me feel nervous and insecure. Sarah didn't have this comparison, but because she hadn't been in the Court of Protection before. But for me, because I've been at many other cases, the most striking feature was the lack of empathy that I experienced for Sarah. People just didn't take into account how she might be feeling or reacting. And I think, in fact, they'd forgotten after the first couple of hours when she gave her witness statement, they forgot that she was there. I'm pleased at the reaction that my blog piece has created or contributed to. The barristers involved in the case reworked their own report to include Sarah's perspective. The Transparency Project itself has published an additional two pieces, one about the gulf between legal lawyers and lay parties, and one about a perspective from a judge, in which the judge also expresses some concern about being compromised in their ability to conduct hearings with empathy, understanding, and compassion. And Mr. Justice McDonald has said that feedback from the lay party in the proceedings has provided a significant counterweight to the foregoing positive assessments, and asks that people pay careful regard to the issues that we raised, which he then also produces quite a lot of suggestions for maintaining and adhering to the seriousness, the solemnity, and the professional decorum of the court. I know that remote hearings are going to have to happen, and this is not that I want to throw the whole idea of remote hearings out of the window, but I do think we need to find ways of ensuring that lay participants in particular do feel that they are getting a first-rate hearing, and that they are being listened to, and that compassion and empathy are being given as much prominence as they are in face-to-face hearings as well. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Celia, and I hope you're still with us in real time, if only by audio. We were going to take just a minute pause, or a minute and a half, just to so everybody can rest their eyes for a second. It's a long time to be staring at a screen. If you have questions from the speakers, please do type them into the chat box now, or you can also you'll get a chance to raise your hand. There's a raise hand function at the side in the chat box. So when we come back, we'll take some questions. I'd just like to thank all of our speakers again. That was absolutely fascinating, and I think a really, really good overview of some of the issues. So we'll break for 60 seconds and see you in a minute. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone. Just to say as well that I realised you can clap, of course. You can use the reactions button at the bottom of everybody's screen if you want to clap later on. And if you're in the chat mode and you put your hand on the if you put your mouse over your icon, you should be able to turn on raised hand, which we'll do in a bit. If anybody else wants to take some time to stand up and have a bit of exercise, I'm going to go and get a glass of water.
Thanks. It's hard to tell if people have come back or not, because some people's videos are off and I can see some people popping back into view. And I'm also just working out how to use the different, you can scroll through frames to see who's in here. Okay. So I think in the interest of time, we should restart. And how should we run this, A? Are you putting together questions from the chat, or shall I just?
So I've got a couple of questions from the chat that I can feed to you, Emma, if you want to start with that or go straight into the discussion.
Brilliant, thank you. Because we don't have much time, I think we should do it, question and answer as a discussion panel. So if we take a question, maybe take two or three questions, and then we can put them to the panel, and the panel can respond between them as they see appropriate. So, Emily, do you just want to fire the first few questions from the chat? And if other people have questions they want to put forward in the meantime, that's fine, or you can raise your hand and we'll come to you in a second.
So the first question, is specifically a question for Natalie. It's, does she think intermediaries will be able to adequately support vulnerable defendants remotely? Would they have to be co-located to be successful?
Thank you so much. And I think that's Joe Easton, who knows much more about this than I do, who's asked the question. So thank you very much for the question. I think it's a really difficult one. All of the evidence suggests that the thing that makes the difference is having a supporter with you, physically located next to you, in order to enable you to understand what's happening and deal with any questions that you had. We don't, one of the real problems with this whole situation is that we don't have a really good evidence base for what effective adjustments look like when we're thinking about all parties being separate. Obviously, asking intermediaries to go physically to where people in hearings are, you know, you're then stepping back into putting their own health at risk in order to do that. But it is, it's quite difficult to say what would be effective beyond that. And I'd be interested to hear other people's reflections on whether or not actually having a supporter join you remotely in the hearing would be effective in terms of providing effective support to participate effectively.
Thanks, Natalie. Emily, were there more questions from the chat?
So I'm looking at one on immigration that Natalie has, I think, already answered. We've got another one from Issy. It's, do we know whether HMCTS is developing its own plans to evaluate or monitor what is happening in this unusual period?
I can take that. So they are developing their own plans to monitor what's happening, and this is an issue that they're certainly alive to. One of the real issues is that they are operating with, I think, only a third of their staff and under huge pressure to maintain volume and pace of hearings that are being conducted. And this means that when the balance is being drawn between collecting data, often they're saying, well, it's just too much of it's a disproportionate burden to put on our staff to ask us to do additional things beyond arranging hearings. There is, however, I think a balance to be struck here, because if you are so overstretched that you're unable to complete even really basic information about who's having a hearing and what's happening, what does that suggest about your capacity to facilitate an effective hearing in any case? And I hope that it will settle down, but I think it's really important that everyone who's on the call, everyone who's on this discussion, really sort of raises this as an issue, the vital importance of recording what's happening and collecting data, and the need to obviously do that in a way that's proportionate, but that the idea that we could come through this period with no better understanding than we had before of some of these issues that have been raised is just unconscionable to me. So I would really encourage everyone who's concerned in this to kind of amplify that message that we need to be recording hearings and collecting, basic data, even to show due regard to principles under the Equality Act You know, that's something the Human Rights Committee is going to be interested in, the, you know, the Government Equalities Office should be interested in, and I think we all really need to be united in making that case for why it matters.
I saw Nimrod, am I pronouncing that correctly? I saw his hand go up, so I'm going to unmute him for his question, and then I can pop back onto the chat to take Jensen's question. I'm really sorry if I'm mispronouncing anybody's names. Okay.
Thanks, Emily.
Nimrod, you can speak now.
Projecting. Just to come in on what Natalie has just said, I mean, in discussions in discussions we've had internally among law centers, as well as ones that I have had as head of policy of Law Centers Network with HMCTS, MOJ, LAA, all of the acronyms, it's clear that there is a gap that HMCTS already acknowledge, at least behind closed doors, between guidance and advice and practice in the hearings that are held remotely. The Internal Tribunal, for example, has basically ground to a halt. They're only doing preliminary hearings of 1 hour each and adjourning until the autumn, hopefully. They say it's because of a lack of IT and operational staff rather than judges, but you know, you wonder how different things are that they're unable to cope. We see anecdotal evidence about the Benefits Tribunal basically casually sidelining representatives because they don't get the messages about listings and postponements of hearings held remotely. Their clients do, and they hear from the client rather than from the tribunal. Also, where there aren't enough lines to patch everyone in, so the ones who are expendable seem to be the representatives. So we know of one court in particular that's a combined court. One line is for crime, three lines were for benefits, two of them were for the panel members, one was for the appellant, and that was it. And the appellant had a representative who was waiting in a third location in order to be patched in. So we have this accumulating evidence that I do raise with them. I get the sense that overall there is an urgency among most of the people concerned to just crack on with it because c'est la guerre, but it's not good enough. And I worry that, some of these practices will ossify. And we'll be stuck with them once this is all over. So I agree with you, Natalie. I'm not sure how, though, to do that in a concerted way. And I would be happy to collaborate with anyone who has a good suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you, Nimrod. Natalie, have you got anything to add to that, or should we move on to some of the other questions that are coming through? I don't know if you... I think you're muted, sorry.
Sorry. No, completely happy to move on. I mean, I think at a basic level, simply encouraging, like, record all hearings. HMCTS have cloud storage. It's not expensive to store these hearings. And if you were to agree that we could store those hearings for a period of, 6 years, 1 year, whatever, to facilitate, at least then we would have a better understanding and a better chance of understanding actually what happens. But I think just getting the agreement it's not sufficient, because there will be huge gaps in what's recorded, and we know that. But without doing that, at a bare minimum, it's really difficult to see how we will emerge out of this with any better understanding than we had before.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry, Emma.
No, it's fine. Carry on, Emily, if you've got more questions.
There was a question about before COVID, was there a country anywhere which has implemented a developed system for remote hearings? Natalie's answered that in the chat. So another one that came up, does the panel know of any technological solution slash system that could deal with block possession lists during the corona crisis whilst ensuring tenants can get access to free advice or representation by a duty solicitor?
I can try and talk to that. For people that don't know, this is Jensen Lamb's question. Jensen is a super duty lawyer, housing possession duty lawyer. And as he knows, these block lists are they're in the county court for district judges. Anything up to, you know, 40 cases listed in a row in a day. As duty advisor, you see anything between none and 25 of those cases, possibly. It's pretty quick knockabout justice in housing possession proceedings. It's very difficult. I think what Jensen's getting at, it's very difficult to see a technological solution to that kind of hearing. But if I can just sort of talk very quickly to a brief email exchange that Natalie and I had about vulnerability and remote hearings. It seems to me if you're going to do that kind of work with say video technology, then you're going to need to have some kind of weighting, some sort of vulnerability, perhaps a digital illiteracy weighting to the hearing itself, which is going to mean really just fundamentally shifting, you know, what we know about the principles of justice itself. So the whole idea of equality of arms is going to have to be slightly shifted to an understanding that, you know, how do you achieve equality of arms when you've got people who are not necessarily going to ever be comfortable with the technology, who are up against people whose, you know, day-to-day business it is to be comfortable with this technology. So it's very difficult to see. And as I finish my piece, I don't actually think that should happen. I think that, you know, once this crisis is over, I think we should maintain court hearings with people, certainly digitally assisted, and certainly options for digital technology to enhance access to justice. But as Nimrod just said, we do not want to ossify some of the really quite, to go back to the cowboy metaphor, Wild West sort of practices that were being forced to, at, you know, stress testing at pace. We this really does need to be done in an extremely thoughtful and properly researched way if the technology is actually going to benefit.
Thank you, Simon. I think that's a really important point, and I just want to link that to another question, which is about whether there's been a country before that's implemented a developed system for remote hearings. And I'm not sure if any of the panelists would be able to answer that. There might be some expertise. Okay, brilliant. I think it is important to realise that there are some things we do already know about this as well. I'll pass to you, Natalie, to say more to that.
Thank you. So, I mean, the system that I know most about is the Civil Resolution Tribunal in British Columbia. It has recently taken over jurisdiction for personal injury claims, but prior to that, it dealt with small claims, strata, which is a type of housing dispute. And I think others, I mean, Darren Thompson, I believe, is on the call, and he was one of the architects of that system. So I'm sure he'd be more willing to provide more information about this. And the things to note about the Civil Resolution Tribunal is that they actually reformed the law and underlying processes before they overlaid the technology on top of that to make it simpler. And I think this is one of the issues. What we're doing at the moment is trying to transpose a physical process that's not been simplified onto a kind of digital platform without really paying sort of paying enough attention to like what that means and what differences that creates. I know that there is a website that's been set up by the Society for Computers and Law, which is sharing practice of the way in which remote hearings are being introduced around the world, and some of the resources on there might be worth looking at for people who are interested in international comparators. But I can share some of the articles that Darren and Shannon Salter, who's the chair of that resolution tribunal, have written about this, if that's helpful for people.
Thanks very much. Just on that point, it's worth noting that the tribunal looks at sort of small claims and condominium disputes, so is very perhaps really useful to look at, but is very different from what's going on at the minute in the wider sense. The issues are much less at stake. Liberty is not at stake.
I totally agree with that. And they were very express in when they started looking at this to focus on the kind of issues where there were the least risk to sort of life and liberty. And it's also worth saying, to live in a condominium, the type of person who's a tenant in those condominiums tends to be on a higher income, so we're not talking about. The other research that's worth looking at is the introduction of these sort of video links in criminal settings and in bail hearings in the US, and the findings from that have actually not been great. But again, it's worth saying that again was about delivering a process that's designed to be conducted physically using technology, not about reforming the process, making it simpler. And I think what is interesting is the whole rhetoric around reform in general, around user-centered design, that only works if you design the underlying law around the user as well, and that's not been done. There's no attempt to do that. The online bill that Matt mentions in his presentation, the fact that, you know, that fell, it meant that there were no opportunities to kind of look at what are we trying to achieve with the system, and then design for that and then overlay technology. And that's a fundamental issue, I think.
Thank you. I'm just going to take two final questions, which I think is all we have time for, but I can see there are more messages coming in, so I'm really sorry if we haven't got as far as the questions that you've asked. So the final two questions, which are in some way related, are, one is from Judith Townend, who has said, Celia's blog post has clearly had a huge impact and influencing practice going forwards. How do we ensure other participants' voices are heard and listened to by the people administering remote hearings and developing future policy and court reform? And the other question is about research ethics. So from Jamie Lindsay, which is whether research ethics for observing and researching virtual hearings, around that issue, have any of the speakers had experience with getting ethical and Ministry of Justice approval for observing virtual hearings, and what kinds of issues arise? So a couple of interesting questions. So I'll open it up to anybody on the panel who wants to address those.
I think the brilliant work that PLP have done in trying to collect information about the experience of users, and, you know, huge congratulations for being so quick off the mark and getting that survey off the ground, because it's really important. I think I agree in terms of ensuring that people's voices are represented in this, and that more people are able to have a voice in the space. I think it is really hard, isn't it? I guess it comes down to, you know, collecting those experiences, making contact with the Justice Select Committee, thinking about what we can do as a community to ensure that, you know, the voices, particularly vulnerable people, aren't lost in this process. But I'd be really interested to kind of hear from everyone else on the call what they think we could practically do in order to ensure that that's the case.
Comments in the chat, please, if you've got ideas. I don't know, Joe, do you want to say anything about ethics and observations?
Yeah, so at least at this stage, the obstacles are mainly practical, just in terms of just getting access. I think, as Judith said in the chat, it's quite difficult, and it's on quite an ad hoc basis, and sometimes it's only for accredited journalists rather than public observers. And whereas once, if it's an oral hearing, you could just wander into a court building, depending on what court it is, and just go into hearings in a fairly informal way. It's obviously very difficult to do that in a remote setting. So there's the initial practical barriers, which hopefully we can get round in the next few weeks. My experience really is in in-person hearings and observing them, and I imagine a lot of ethical questions around getting informed consent and not interrupting the process of a hearing that may affect, in a way that could affect its outcome, would also apply to observing remote hearings. So a lot of questions still to answer. I guess it's a negotiation rather than being able to firmly say what you could, you know, how you can mitigate, at least in in-person hearings. I try and speak to appellants and lawyers beforehand and try and inform them who I am and why I'm a public observer. And so maybe trying to replicate those kind of workarounds in a remote setting could be helpful. Yeah, thanks for your question, Rose. Good question.
Thank you. So it's nearly 5:30 and we're due to finish. So to keep to time, I hope that's okay with everyone. I'm aware that it's a fascinating discussion and it could probably go on for much longer. We really appreciate the sort of interest in the event today and really appreciate the time of our speakers and their fascinating insight into what is a really quickly developing issue. It's so hard to keep track of developments day on day. So, I mean, hopefully maybe there's space for more like this. I don't know. I'm looking at Aidan and Emily, who have been fantastic in organising this at short notice. So I don't want to make any promises. But I believe there was a request for some feedback. So I might just pass back to Aid or Emily to explain what they'd like, and by way of feedback from people, if you've enjoyed today. And finally, just to thank the speakers again, please do use your clapping function if you can work out how to do that, which I still can't on Zoom. But thank you very much. It's been really exciting event to organise and to host today. So thank you.
Thank you, Emma. And I can see lots of people worked out to use their hand clap. So thank you all. We're all imagining the round of applause that's emanating through the internet. We are planning more sessions, not necessarily on online courts, but there'll be another Radio PLP session soon, which will be free. We'll also be asking feedback when we send round a Google feedback form. After this, we'll send around all the information, all the links that came through the chat and everything else, so everybody has access to everything that was mentioned along the way. And that's it. Is there anything else, Emily, that we need to tell?
I think, just as Aid mentioned, keep an eye out for an email from me that's going to contain all of the links that were in the chat, as well as a link to the feedback form. It's a Google form. It's very simple. It'll take 20 seconds to fill out. So please do, because I do promise I read the feedback and take it into consideration when planning more events. And again, if you have any questions or comments or anything at all, please don't hesitate to drop me an email.
Or if you've got suggestions for other Radio PLP broadcasts, yes, as well, they'll all be welcome. But we'll provide you all with that forum. Once again, just thank you to all of our speakers. And I think that's it. I think we hit the stop record button.